HBpodcraft.com.
I began to think of all the long, long way I had journeyed. How I had found a brook and followed it on, and gone through bushes and thorny thickets and dark woods full of creeping thorns. Then I had crept up a tunnel under trees and climbed a thicket and seen all the gray rocks and sat in the middle of them when they turned round. And then I had gone on through the gray rocks and come down a hill through the stinging thicket and up the dark valley all a long, long way. I wondered how I should get home again, if I could ever find the way. So I sat down on the grass and thought what I should do next.
That was an excerpt from Arthur Machen's The White People, H.P. Lovecraft's second favorite weird tale, and we're going to continue our coverage of it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at HBpodcraft.com. My name is Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
Our reader is once again Heather Klinke. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Heather.
You know, aside from being a dynamite reader, Heather is also an astute critical thinker. We were once in the St. Louis airport, and I was purchasing a Maxim, which is a men's magazine, and it had a scantily clad woman on the cover. I was just reading it for the articles.
Of course you were.
Actually, you know, people used to say that about Playboy. I'm only reading it for the articles. And that was a legit excuse because they did have good fiction in there.
They did.
And occasionally some good journalism. But you really couldn't say that about Maxim because I hope you're looking at it for the photos because the articles are like an opinion piece like, bro, these chicken wings, hot!
But you were reading it for the articles.
There's probably something in there I was interested in. And the clerk that was checking me out, she shakes her head at the magazine and she said, that's immoral, like under her breath.
Wow.
As I was buying it, and then she didn't speak to me the rest of the time she checked me out, and I was kind of shocked by it.
Yeah.
And I went back to the gate and I told Heather, and she said, are you sure that she didn't say that's amore? Which is critical thinking. And it's the kind of thing our readers have for the show. It's the kind of thing we bring to our analysis of these stories. We're on the second half of our coverage of The White People. What has happened so far?
We left off looking at the journal of a 16-year-old girl who we've been calling Helen because I think that that might be her name. Not sure. The journal is bookended with these two guys, Ambrose and Cotgrave. Ambrose is a wise old dude who had this journal and gave it to Cotgrave to give him an example of true sin, as in defying the laws of God in a metaphysical sense. So now Helen, who has seen some weird stuff since she was a child, has gone off into a surreal walk into the woods and has come across the great green wall that might be the edge of the world.
Yes, that's what we're reading from this journal, this green book. The events she is recounting happened on a day when she was 13, nearly 14. Mm-hmm. So strange that the day on which it happened is always called the White Day, she says. Mm-hmm. Her mother had been dead for about a year, and her guardians would let her walk off and roam the countryside in the afternoons after her lessons. And that excerpt at the top kind of recounts that long journey up to the green wall you mentioned.
She looks around this place in the woods and sees that there is a great well there, as in a water well. She looks into it, and it seems magical in some way. So she put her hot feet into it, and it cools her down, and then she feels re-energized. She's not tired anymore. She wants to see what is beyond this wall. So she climbs the wall and looks over it, saying she is in the queerest country I had ever seen, stranger even than the hill of the gray rocks. It looked as if earth children had been playing there with their spades, as it was all hills and hollows. The castles and walls made of earth and covered with grass. There were two mounds, like big beehives, round and great and solemn, and then hollow basins, and then a steep mounting wall like the ones I once saw by the seaside where the big guns and soldiers were. So I'm not really sure what she's describing there. So it's castles and dug holes and hills and things?
I think it looks a little like Hobbiton, you know, or the Shire. There's like shapes in the grass that are clearly dwellings of some kind and mounds and walls. And I think that there's some trenches and sort of hollows that look dug out. Mm-hmm. I think she's come across some military encampments that have had similar functions, trenches, hollows. She goes down into one of these. It says, I nearly fell into one of the round hollows. It went away under my feet so suddenly, and I ran fast down the side and stood at the bottom and looked up.
Yeah.
Pretty deep.
She says it's like a hollow temple of dead heathen gods which leads into a story that her nurse told her.
Yeah, this whole stream of consciousness narrative is peppered with these breakaway stories. It's very much like stories in the Arabian Nights, where there's nested stories within stories. And she references the Arabian Nights frequently. But this is the first time it happens where we get a little breakaway story from the nurse.
There was a pit, like the one she was standing in, that all the townspeople were afraid to go in. This is the story. Yeah. This girl, who was very poor, ignored everybody and said, "You're all crazy. I'm going in and check it out." So she came back out and she was laughing. And she said, "There's nothing in there but green grass and red stones and white stones and yellow flowers." They noticed that she had these amazing emerald earrings, but she just laughed and said that they weren't emeralds, they're made of grass. So the next day they saw her with a ruby necklace, but she again laughed and told them it's just a red stone. The next day, diamonds? No, white stones. The next day she's in the queen's court and it looks like she has on this amazing crown, better than the queen's. And the king and queen thought that she was some long-lost princess and asked her about her crown. And she just laughed and said, "Oh, that's yellow flowers. That's nothing fancy." But they were so impressed and curious, the king and queen invited her to stay in the castle. And she did, and the prince met her, and he just totally fell in love with her and wanted to marry her. The king said it was okay, and they got married. On their wedding night, the prince went to the door and heard a voice from inside say, "Venture not upon your life. This is mine own wedded wife."
Oh, so somebody's taking her as a bride that's not the prince. And he didn't just hear the voice. He saw a tall black man with a dreadful face standing in front of the door. So I think we can assume this is the black man of the woods from all witchcraft stories that we've covered. I mean, he was in Ancient Sorceries earlier this month.
Yeah.
Back in all of our Hawthorne stories, way back into Lovecraft stories. He's like the Samuel L. Jackson of literature. Like, he's in this too? He's in every story we cover, but this freaks the prince out.
The prince had a seizure, which is creepy. I don't usually get seizures in these sort of stories. But
you seem a little excited about that. You know, people don't realize it because we edit the show fairly heavily, but a lot of times I'll say, "So what did you think of the story? You know, how did you like the quest of Irinon?" And Chris will be like, "Eh, could have used more seizures." You're just always looking for that. The descriptions go on and on and on, and I'm like, when is there going to be a seizure? And it never happens. I don't know what that's about.
Yes, that's not true. The king's men attended the prince, and then they try to break down the door, but they can't. It's like it's made of steel. Not even axes can break it. The next day, they went in and found that there was nothing in the room but this thick black smoke, because the black man had come and taken her away. And on the bed, there were two knots of faded grass and a red stone and some white stones and some faded yellow flowers. I'm not sure what this story is all about. Yeah. What did she do that was... I mean, she went someplace she wasn't supposed to go.
Right.
But she wasn't trying to trick anybody. She told everybody what those things really were.
Well, she made a deal with the devil. I think from her perspective, well, her deal was to realize her dreams. With the riches and the marriage to the prince. And then on the night of her greatest triumph, the devil shows up and takes her as a bride and goes with her as punishment. Maybe. Or more likely, I mean, it also seemed like the Keats poem, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, where it's this beautiful fairy woman who uses magic to attract and then destroy the knight that she has this night of passion with. Mm-hmm. Or like Circe, not from Game of Thrones, but Circe from Greek mythology, an enchantress who likes to kill men.
Sure.
I think the white people were down in that hollow, and the poor girl, they gave the poor girl the tools via these flowers and things that could put a glamour on and look like riches.
Mm-hmm.
And she used those tools to sort of destroy her rich oppressors, maybe.
But she didn't.
Well, the guy had a seizure.
Yeah.
You know, so he probably like soiled himself in front of all the other guards, and he's going to have to live with that now.
But that's about it, you know. It just doesn't seem too fair, but I guess the poor girl wasn't too good at making deals.
I guess, but it's the beginning of a series of stories here in which there is a girl who has a magical life.
Yeah.
She's one way and then turns out to be something else. And so at least it fits that theme.
Anyway, thinking of this story made Helen afraid at where she was at. And so she stands up and she says some words and she does some passes to keep the bad things away. And then she feels better. She starts making her way back through the woods. And then she sees this little creature run into a path down some deep, thicker woods. And she follows it under some thorns and some bushes, and it leads to this open space.
"And there I saw the most wonderful sight I have ever seen. But it was only for a minute, as I ran away directly and crept out of the wood by the passage I had come by, and ran as fast as I ever could, because I was afraid. What I had seen was so wonderful and so strange and beautiful, that I wanted to get home and think of it, and I did not know what might happen if I stayed by the wood. I was hot all over and trembling, and my heart was beating, and strange cries that I could not help came from me as I ran from the wood. I was glad that a great white moon came up over a round hill and showed me the way. So I went back through the mounds and hollows, and down the close valley, and up through the thicket over the place of the gray rocks, and so at last I got home again. My father was busy in his study, and the servants had not been told about my not coming home, though they were frightened and wondered what they ought to do. So I told them I had lost my way. But I did not let them find out the real way I had been.
So this thing is beyond description. So strange that she wants to just go home and sit and try and figure out what it was that she saw.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
Right. What did she witness? What the heck was it?
We never find out. She never says.
And I guess that's the ultimate weirdness of the tale. You know, that's why it would be up to that high standard that Lovecraft has for weird fiction.
Yeah.
This last thing that she encountered blew her mind, but we never get to be privy to what it was.
So that night she lays in bed thinking about her strange day, and it makes her remember all these old stories that her nurse told her when she was young. Now she kind of sees them in a new light. She starts to wonder if the nurse was actually the lady with the ivory white skin and black hair and eyes. It doesn't make sense to her because she's seen her sort of in the same place, but not actually together. Weird. It's weird.
Yeah.
So Helen remembers another story that she heard about a young man who went hunting with his dogs, and he was on horseback. He had been hunting all day, but with no luck, and then he saw this white stag, and he wanted to chase it, but his dogs and his horse, they would not pursue. The dogs whined, the horse would get all weird and stuff, so he just jumped off and went on foot. Now, he had a gun, but he never used it because he felt like this desire to actually grab it with his hands, to catch it.
He wanted to use karate on it.
Yeah. That's the, if you're a hunter, if you're like a real hunter, you're not going to use any weapons. That's
no.
That's weak sauce, man. Use freaking karate.
Karate is the best.
So all you big tough guy hunters with your guns, I want to see you karate chop that deer next time.
That's right. I want to see you out there hunting with a gi, a white gi, so that the so that the animal can see you coming, and you still have to use karate to kill.
Karate that deer. You can do it. I mean, if you're tough. So he chases this deer all night. You know, it gets a bit trippy as he's running through the woods.
He goes on a similar journey, actually, to the little girl in the story.
Yeah.
When he goes on this chase after the stag, he crosses through woods and rivers and marshes, and there are will-o'-the-wisps in the air, those supernatural things. I should have been introduced to will-o'-the-wisps in Dracula where they appeared, but I actually was introduced to them because there was a Spider-Man villain called Will-o'-the-Wisp. Do you remember that guy?
Oh, yeah. You know I do.
Anyway, this guy crosses through valleys, etc., and he winds up in a country that's unlike any he's ever seen before.
When morning finally hits, he gets so close to touching the stag, but it fades off into the earth. And this just bums him out so much, he cries. And not like just kind of a sob, like, you know, full-on snotty face. As he cries, he sees a door going into the side of the hill, and he opens it. Then, all of a sudden, he's in this glen with a fountain, and there's a beautiful woman in white.
Yes, she is the queen of the fairies, and she changed herself into a stag in order to lead him to this place.
And she gives him a drink, and he's super into it. He's super into her, and then she kisses him, and he kisses her back, and then she becomes his wife. And he stays there all day and another night in the hill.
Yeah.
And when he wakes up, he's on the ground by his horses and his dogs.
And there's no Queen of the Fairies there.
Nope.
Again, it's that La Belle Dame sans Merci scenario, except that he's not physically destroyed by the encounter. Not physically.
No, not physically. He lived a long life, but he never kissed another woman because he kissed the Queen of the Fairies, and no woman's going to compare to that. Right. And he never drank wine again because he drank the wine of the Fae.
That's too good.
But it doesn't say that he didn't kiss any guys or drink Pabst Blue Ribbon. So that's probably what happened.
See, critical thinking. That's the critical thinking that I'm talking about. That's amore. That's amore.
Helen remembers that her nurse also told her that her great-grandmother was the one who told her the story originally, and she knew about the hills around there and the rites that went on in the summer and the dancing and the trees and the secret paths in the woods. And there's this creepy bit here. It says, and all kinds of people would come. There would be gentlefolk and village folk and some old people and some boys and girls and quite small children who just sat and watched. Man, that sounds like creepy, inappropriate stuff to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would be tempted to say, oh, come on, they're just dancing, but I think it's more than that. And it also says in one corner there's someone burning something that smelt strong and sweet and made them laugh.
Yeah.
At best, there's some doobie contact highs going on. And at worst, they're like freebasing cocaine.
Yes.
And but even without the sex, they're acting all crazy. And I think It's so weird to be a little kid around adults who are like that. Like,
yeah.
I spent a lot of time when I was a kid at the local bar waiting around for my dad to wrap up the conversation with his pals, which would last really long sometimes. And you know, for about an hour, I'd be fine playing the pinball machine by the door. But then, you know, the adults would start acting weird.
Yeah.
You know, because they were getting more drunk and they'd want to talk to me and I didn't quite understand it. And It was the worst. And sometimes an old song would come on the jukebox and they'd get up and be jerking around arrhythmically. And I'd be like, what's going on? And I imagine it's a scenario a little like that. That stuff is pretty terrifying when you're a kid. And that's why I keep it all locked up in a little room in my head.
God.
Where nobody must ever go. Maybe the nurse has another story. Let's hear about that.
Yeah, she does. There's this other story. It's about a guy on a horse who got lost.
Basically, he got lost in this very area where the rituals would happen.
And then when his horse wouldn't go any further, he decided he would.
Yeah, he's going to keep going. And he hears shouting and singing and crying like nothing he's ever heard before. And it says it all sounded quite close to him, but he couldn't get in to the thicket where it was happening. And so he began to call.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was calling, something came behind him. And in a minute, his mouth and arms and legs were all bound up and he fell into a swoon. No seizure, just a swoon.
Yeah.
And when he came to himself, he was lying by the roadside.
He ended up where he had started.
I think what happened was he accidentally fell upon this ritual and they 86'd him. Like,
right.
You know, he showed up and they're like, hey, anybody know that guy?
So Helen goes on about these rituals where they would dance all night and eat and drink wine, and some people would just disappear and never be seen again ever.
That sounds fun.
The nurse told her they would make little statues of clay and then they would worship them.
And we get a little tutorial on these little clay statues.
Helen says that the nurse took her into the woods and made her promise not to tell anyone. They made this little clay person, some kind of action figure, I'm guessing.
That's what I was thinking too. Nurse took the clay out of the bucket and began to knead it with her hands and do queer things with it and turn it about. She began to shape it into a doll, but not like the dolls I have at home. She made the queerest doll I have ever seen and hid it under a bush to get dry and hard. So we left the doll there, and a few days later we went the same walk till we got to the green place where the little clay man was hidden. She did all sorts of queer things with the little clay man, and I noticed she was all streaming with perspiration, that we had walked so slowly. And then she told me to pay my respects, and I did everything she did because I liked her. It was such an odd game. She said that if one loved very much, the clay man was very good, and one did certain things with it. And if one hated very much, it was just as good, only one had to do different things. And we played with it a long time and pretended all sorts of things. Nurse said her great-grandmother had told her all about these images, but what we did was no harm at all, only a game.
Hmm.
But these are like satanic love and hate rituals that are going to manifest in the real world, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
That she's showing her.
What's really creepy about these and why I keep thinking it's really effed up stuff is that there's so much omitted. Like she just says, we played with it a long time and pretended all sorts of things.
Yeah.
What is that? I mean, it could be completely innocent or it could be really messed up.
No, none of this stuff is innocent. But the nurse, after they've put together this little clay figure, even though she's saying it's just a game, she tells the little girl a story about these figures.
Yes. There was this noble lady who was smoking hot and all these guys wanted to marry her. She didn't want to marry them because she just didn't like them very much.
Mm-hmm.
And her father really wanted her to marry. So she told these guys to wait a year and a day and she'd make her choice. And there are five guys.
But the truth was, she was the queen of the people who danced on the hill on summer nights. Her real name was the Lady Avalyn. But the dancing people called her Cassop, which meant somebody very wise in the old language. And she was wider than any of them and taller. And her eyes shone in the dark like burning rubies. And she could sing songs that none of the others could sing. And when she sang, they all fell down on their faces and worshipped her. She's a little bit like, you know, the mother in ancient sorceries. She's, the queen of the debauchery.
Right. So she is one of the white people, or at least descended from them. It's hard to say exactly why she's living in human society. And her father's there, and he's not privy to what she is.
Right, and she calls him her father, so I wonder if she's some sort of changeling or something like that, which is a fairy tradition, right?
Yeah, of course.
She would tell her father that she was going out to the woods to gather flowers, but when she'd get there, her maid would keep watch, and she did this very strange thing. She'd lay down on the ground singing these strange songs.
And all these snakes would crawl up on her and they would cover her from head to toe. And she whispered to them and she sang to them and they writhed round and round faster and faster until she told them to go. They leave a multicolored stone on her chest, which was called a glam stone or a glam stone.
And with it, one could do all sorts of wonderful things.
The lady did not want to get married, so she had a scheme. Since all of her suitors had to wait a year and a day for her to decide, they all went off. But one of them, Sir Simon, was super into her and had very feminine qualities. So he pretended to be a servant girl in the lady's house.
Yeah, that was his scheme. He wanted to see why they had to wait a year and a day, what she was up to.
He found out after months and months that she had this little wax doll under her bed and that she would put the glam stone in it. And then there was this handsome man there out of nowhere. And they would eat cake together. And then in the morning, the man was gone and the doll was back under the bed. Sir Simon, he just couldn't believe it. But over the next few nights, stuff happened. He heard her do a spell on Sir Dickon that he'll drown. Next day, he drowns.
Yeah.
She does a spell on Sir Richard. He's going to get hung by robbers. He does. They all die until it's Sir Simon is the only one that's left of her suitors.
Right.
So I thought maybe at this point, Sir Simon was going to reveal himself and say that he knows who she was or what she was a part of, and that he loved her anyway, and that maybe he would become her new doll or something. I don't know. Some weird fairy thing, but he would get, you know, roped into it because he was into her. But no way, man. He just goes and turns her into the cops.
Yeah.
And then she's captured and she's burned alive in the town square.
Mm-hmm.
And then extra creepy at the end, her little wax man was burned with her and it screamed as it melted.
Oof.
That's pretty creepy. Anyway, Helen, this is why I think she's called Helen, remembers a queer rhyme that the nurse used to say to her. She said, Halsey, Cumsey, Helen, Musty.
Right.
And so Helen is capitalized and it's the only word there that is a name. So I'm thinking,
it's a good stab at it. I don't think that's the case. I think this is a nursery rhyme that the nurse said to her, and it's an old one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she inserted her name into it. I don't think it's in English because when she says Halsey Cumsey, that sounds like Latin to me. So I think it's an old Latin thing. That's just how she's sounding it out. We can still call her Helen, but I don't think that is proof that her name is Helen.
Well, no, it's not proof. She thinks of the song as she's lying there in bed, because remember, she's still lying in bed after she had her shock and just thinking about all these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And she thinks of that song. She finally falls asleep. And it's the next day. She's totally tired. To lift her spirits, she does this dancing game called Troy Town.
Right. She does her little dance to cheer herself up. And then she sees that opening in the hill where she had gone on her strange journey. It was like a little secret passageway.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that last episode, she'd kissed that magical puddle.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd whispered to the nymph inside of the puddle that she would come again. Remember, she recounted the story of the girl who was burnt for not wanting to marry, and she was actually queen of the fairies. And earlier, there was the story of the stag, and the stag was really the queen of the fairies.
Mm-hmm.
I think when she looked into that puddle, the nymph she saw was her own reflection.
Oh.
And she's the nymph. She's actually the innocent girl who's actually the queen of the fairies. And her kiss was an encounter with this part of her nature. But eventually, as promised, she said she'd come again. She's going to make that trip again, and she's going to have to embrace or reject this reflection.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. Helen says that she told her dad once about the nurse's stories, and he got really angry and told the nurse off.
Yeah, he says only common, ignorant people believed in such rubbish.
The nurse got ticked at her for telling her dad and made her promise not to ever tell anybody again what she tells her, or a great black snake would come out of the pool and bite her.
Jeez, that snake, Samuel L. Jackson.
What?
Yep, he's in everything.
He's in everything. Now, once in the woods, she's sitting on the hill thinking about whether or not these stories that her nurse told her were actually true or were they just made up.
Mm-hmm.
She remembers how the nurse showed her how to move stuff with her mind. Telekinesis, Kyle.
Whoa.
And she could do it. Helen was able to move dishes off of the counter in the kitchen. And she also taught her how to make rapping noises with her mind as well.
The bit about this is amazing because I've never seen it described this way. It's almost like how a poltergeist is described. It's not about moving the particular objects. It's about moving the frame of reference. She says one could turn a whole house upside down without anybody being able to find out. And the pots and pans would jump about and the china would be broken and the chairs would tumble over of themselves. I tried it one day in the kitchen and I found I could do it quite well. And a whole row of plates on the dresser fell off it and cook's little work table tilted up and turned right over. Which is, that's such a weird thing. The house is what actually moved, but the people inside have no frame of reference because they didn't move. And so it seems to them that everything else moved.
Yeah.
That was just a crazy section.
That's some cool other reality kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That really makes it weird.
She just did it innocently. She doesn't even really know what she's doing.
Yeah. She wants to ask the nurse about the truth of it all, but she can't because the nurse is gone. 2 years ago, since she's writing this, and no one knows what happened to her. She just kind of disappeared one day. Then Helen goes to this place where they made the little clay guy, and then she does this weird thing. She says, I covered up my face with my hands and lay down flat on the grass, and I stayed there for 2 hours without moving, whispering to myself delicious, terrible things and saying some words over and over again. So Helen gets this plan to make a new clay man better than the one before.
She does everything the nurse did, making and hiding the clay man. And then a few days later, she embarks on her journey up into the strange woods again.
She finds that standing stone circles again, and they begin to spin around her as she sits and watches them. And then she goes down and she sings and dances with the rocks. Actually, this is something that I've thought about since our last recording. There are legends about trolls turning into rocks. Like if you see a weird looking rock out, it might be a troll during the day, and then at night they unfold and then they, you know, go do their troll stuff. But it's sort of like if it looks like a hunched down troll or a troll bent over, that's how you know that that's not a real rock. It's actually a troll pretending to be a rock. Her talking about these standing rocks, or, you know, moving around and she dancing with the rocks, they could be trolls or the white people or the others, fae, the strange ones.
That's a cool connection.
So she's just totally pooped from all this, and she goes and puts her feet in the water, and the nymphs give her little kisses on her feet. And afterwards, she said the other words and made the signs. And then she gets up and goes into a darker wood. And then she stops and puts on a blindfold. She runs into it, and there are some thorns, and they hurt, but she doesn't cry out.
This was very odd. I mean, she basically repeated everything she'd done on an earlier journey, but around the place that she would have seen whatever it was that she saw.
Mm-hmm.
She blindfolds herself. She even turns around a few times to get herself disoriented. In the epilogue, it says that this is, you know, blindfolding yourself and going in backwards is maybe a common practice in witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so odd, I didn't understand it when I was reading this.
I went to the end of the path. Then I stopped and held up my arms and bowed. And I went round the first time, feeling with my hands, and there was nothing. I went round the second time, feeling with my hands, and there was nothing. Then I went round the third time, feeling with my hands. And the story was all true. And I wish that the years were gone by, and that I had not so long a time to wait before I was happy forever and ever. But there was another thing that happened that day. I went a second time to the secret place. It was at the deep brimming well, and when I was standing on the moss, I bent over and looked in. And then I knew who the white lady was that I had seen come out of the water in the wood long ago when I was quite little. Then I remembered how sometime after I had seen the white people in the wood, Nurse asked me more about them, and I told her all over again. And she listened and said nothing for a long, long time. And at last she said, "You will see her again." So I understood what had happened and what was to happen. And I understood about the nymphs, how I might meet them in all kinds of places. And they would always help me, and I must always look for them and find them in all sorts of strange shapes and appearances. And without the nymphs, I could never have found the secret. And without them, none of the other things could happen. Nurse had told me about them long ago, but she called them by another name, and I did not know what she meant or what her tales of them were about, only that they were very queer. And there were two kinds, the bright and the dark. And both were very lovely and very wonderful. And some people saw only one kind, and some only the other, but some saw both. But usually the dark appeared first, and the bright ones came afterwards, and there were extraordinary tales about them. It was a day or two after I had come home from the secret place that I first really knew the nymphs. Nurse had shown me how to call them, and I had tried, but I did not know what she meant, and so I thought it was all nonsense. But I made up my mind I would try again. So I went to the wood where the pool was, where I saw the white people, and I tried again. The dark nymph Alana came, and she turned the pool of water into a pool of fire.
There's an ellipsis.
Yeah.
There, at the end of that sentence, like it just drifts off, and that's the end of the green book. I don't know, to me it seemed like she embraced her own dark nymphiness.
Could be.
And then had command over the white people, you know, the nymphs, to do her bidding. I don't know. We get to the epilogue now.
Yes, Concrave asks what these nymphs were, to which Ambrose says they're a process. And I don't quite understand what he means by that. Just that they're a means to an end?
They're the means by which a witch can accomplish something. The witch wants to get something done. She bids the nymphs to do it.
So we find out that the girl died and that Ambrose was one of those that actually found her body. She went missing a year after having wrote the green book. He found her in the woods with the thing that she sculpted, her little man under some leaves.
And what was this statue? Well, it was of Roman workmanship, of a stone that with the centuries had not blackened but had become white and luminous. The thicket had grown up about it and concealed it. And in the Middle Ages, the followers of a very old tradition had known how to use it for their own purposes. In fact, it had been incorporated into the monstrous mythology of the Sabbath. You will have noted that those to whom a sight of that shining whiteness had been vouchsafed by chance, or rather, perhaps, by apparent chance, were required to blindfold themselves on their second approach. That is very significant. And is it there still? I sent for tools, and we hammered it into dust and fragments. The persistence of tradition never surprises me, Ambrose went on after a pause. I could name many an English parish where such traditions as that girl had listened to in her childhood are still existent in occult but unabated vigor. No, for me it is the story, not the sequel, which is strange and awful, for I have always believed that wonder is of the soul.
He describes the area she died as a strange, desolate land, not nearly as magical as painted in the green book. She was looking at it through these childish, imaginative lenses.
Or maybe she was physically, that was where she was at, but there was some other spiritual side to that place that she could perceive that he couldn't.
Exactly. I think that might be what it is.
It turns out that she had poisoned herself over time.
That I didn't
I don't
understand.
Know. What does that mean?
It says, was she dead? He says, yes, she had poisoned herself in time.
And that's the end.
When he says it's the story, not the sequel, which is strange and awful, when he says a sequel, does he mean her poisoning herself?
I guess so.
And why did she poison herself?
Wait, I don't know. Maybe it was part of her becoming the other thing, going into the woods and joining the white people. Maybe she had to get rid of her body.
When we heard her say, I wish that the years were gone by and that I had not so long a time to wait before I was happy forever and ever.
Yeah.
Implies that she's like, I don't want to grow old and die because it's the death where I'm going to be free. So she poisoned herself to get there earlier out of some impatience.
By her dying, does she go somewhere else or does she just end her existence? It's very strange and unknowable, this story, and I think intentionally so. I think it was very effective and I understand why Lovecraft really loved it.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there is kind of a crescendo of horror here, I think, when she says, when she puts the blindfold on and enters this thing that's already strange and menacing.
Mm.
When she says, I went around the third time feeling with my hands and the story was all true. That means she felt something that confirmed that all of this was true. What the heck is that?
I don't know.
That you physically feel with your hands that confirms that all of the supernatural is true. Well, I'm glad we talked about it. Now, next month, it's October, Halloween, my birthday. We didn't do Werewolf History Month this year. I want some werewolves.
Yeah.
And we're going for what is considered the Dracula for werewolves.
Werewolf in Paris.
By Guy Endor. He of the alligators turning into dragons. I've already started reading this book and it's really awesome. So I'm looking forward to covering it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
We're going to spend the whole month on it, I believe.
Yeah, the whole month. So please tune in for that. The Werewolf of Paris. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I want to thank Andrew Lehman for being amazing and Heather Klinke for also being amazing.
You guys are fantastic. You can see both of them appearing soon in a short film that Chris wrote. It's called Search and Seizure. Andrew plays a detective. Heather plays his spastic assistant who is prone to having seizures. It's almost all seizures. I don't quite understand where the detective story comes in, but it's got a great title. Congratulations on that, Chris. That should be coming out soon. That's all we've got for this week. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.